has gathered many inquiries that people may have about spiritual life or about things in general. So he's going to field some questions to me. Apparently he's going to challenge me a little bit as well. If he dares. And then we're going to have a little bit of a debate. So we want also all of you to get in the questioning mode. Sometimes when you come here, you just come to accept everything, isn't it? You come in the mood of acceptance most of the time, isn't it?
Yeah.
You don't come in the mood of challenging, do you?
No.
Not really. But today we want you to challenge a little bit. We want you to think, well, why is that true? How is that true? Is that really true? Do I really agree with that? Because sometimes it's good to ask questions. You know what Einstein said once? Never stop questioning. Curiosity has its own reason for existing. The moment you stop asking questions is the moment you stop growing. Of course, some people don't want to grow. Be happy not to start, to stop crying. No, we must ask questions. Even when you accept Krishna consciousness, it's still good to ask questions. Aren't all of our scriptures based on questions and answers? Isn't it? Arjuna had so many questions for Krishna. Therefore, the Bhagavad Gita came about. Parikshit had so many questions for Sukadev Goswami. Therefore, the Srimad Bhagavatam came about. We even have a book in our movement called Perfect Questions,
Perfect
Answers. Once we had a stall at Rath Yatra, they said, Perfect Questions, Perfect Answers. And I was sitting underneath it, and someone came up to me and said, he just pointed like that, he said, who should I get married to? I don't know if I can give a perfect answer to that. And I don't know if that's perfect question. It's a nice question. Of course, they once asked Socrates, should I get married? And you know what Socrates said? Definitely you should get married, he said to the person. The person said, wow, you said that with such surety. He said, definitely you should get married. He said, why? So Socrates said, look, after your marriage, if it's a good marriage, you'll be very happy. And if the marriage is a little rocky, don't worry, you'll become a philosopher like me. Either way, you win. So many questions are there, so we should always question. So Mohan here is going to field some questions. And then we're going to open it up to all of you in case you may have some questions. So will you come up with some questions? Will you?
Yes.
Please do. Then it will be very nice. Okay, so Mohan, over to you.
Hare Krishna Maharaj.
Is that Mike?
Mike's on. No, it's not.
Mike's on. Ooh, now it's on.
Hare Krishna. Okay, so this is a fantastic opportunity. I remember once when we were in the Brahmacharya Ashram, and you told me that the quality of your question determines the quality of your life. So, yes, it's a really wonderful opportunity to be able to question you. So my first question that I have in mind is that, you know, we were speaking about it upstairs, and even there's a lot of curiosity, especially when you go out on books. Everybody wants to contribute to this society. Everybody wants to make a difference. Everybody wants to make a change. And you even yourself mentioned that you want to make a difference. You want to make an impact. You want to make a change. So why in particular a monk life? It doesn't really seem like much is happening there. Why did you choose to become a monk? How do you feel that by being a monk, you're able to contribute to the world and to the society? And it may seem funny, but you know, not a lot of leaders actually, even nowadays, they're very dominant with power, with whatever gets an instant result. So why monk? Why did you choose to be a monk?
Hmm. One person once asked me, I was walking along the street, and he said, hey, what do you have to give up to become a monk? So I said, just give up suffering. But let me rewind. First, let's understand how to make the world a better place. Everyone wants to make the world a better place, but how do we actually make the world a better place? Has the world actually become a better place over the last 100 years? Has it? Maybe we have better technology. Maybe we have better economies. Maybe we have more entertainment and more gadgets. But has the world actually become a better place? They say we have taller buildings but shorter tempers, wider highways but narrower minds. We have more conveniences but less time. We're more connected but we're further apart. People buy more but they enjoy less. We've increased our possessions but reduced our values. So in what way has the world actually become a better place? Along with all of the advancement in technology and other things, the world needs spiritual knowledge. Because without spiritual knowledge, all of those things won't make people happier. And if you don't believe me about whether people are happier or not, just go out there and see the numbers of people who suffer with such problems inside their own self, because they in some sense have many things but still have a vacuum within. So therefore, the first question before even answering your question is, the way to really make the world a better place is through spiritual knowledge. And now then, why did I become a monk? Because it's not that you have to be a monk to make the world a better place. Anyone can imbibe spiritual knowledge in their life, even if they're living in the world, in a household of life, and they can share that knowledge and make the world a better place. But the life of a monk is a privileged opportunity. I consider myself to have a privileged opportunity to spend all of my time just trying to share spiritual knowledge with others. I've been given the opportunity to be free from many other social obligations, which allows me to give my full time for sharing spirituality with others. So, how are monks making a difference? Because monks are giving spiritual knowledge in the world. And in a world in which there's so much advancement but a lack of spiritual knowledge, we find that people don't actually become happier. So I'm here just to make you happy.
So my next question is, and it's not on here, but it's just to add to what you said, isn't that selfish to some degree? Because you're giving spiritual wisdom, spiritual knowledge, but what about those people that are in dire and practical situations and circumstances that are difficult to overcome? You know, it kind of brings me back to that quote that if you give a man a fish, we're vegetarian, I know, but if you give a man a fish, he'll be able to only survive and live for a day. But teach someone how to do something and they'll be able to take care of themselves. So how is knowledge, giving knowledge, enough? Especially for someone that may be homeless, or that may be going through depression, or suicidal thoughts, or those kind of mental health challenges.
Very good point. So we try to assist people on all levels. If someone's starving, we don't just go up to them and say, don't worry, here's a Bhagavad Gita. I mean, that's nice. But we will also give them some prasadam. We will also give them some food. If someone has some kind of difficulty in terms of their mental or emotional state, then we'll try to offer assistance or at least guide them to somewhere where they can get assistance. However, there are many, many institutions in this world which are giving physical and mental and emotional help, but there are very few which are giving genuine spiritual wisdom. And so, yes, we will help people on immediate levels, but our USP is to give spiritual knowledge, because that's what other people are not giving. And we give both side by side. Who's more important in a hospital, the nurse or the doctor? What would you say?
The nurse.
The nurse. He thinks the nurse is more important. Does everyone agree? Both. You haven't answered the question? I said, which is more important? And then you said both. Which one is more important, doctor or nurse?
Neither.
Both. Nurse, doctor, which one?
Doctor. Both.
You are right. So I had to just extend it. Because the nurse, if you have the doctor, by the time, especially on the NHS, by the time the doctor comes about, if there ain't no nurses, you may be pretty finito. Because the nurses take care of you on a day-to-day level. So nurses are important, because otherwise you won't survive long enough to see the doctor and have the operation. At the same time, if you only have nurses but you don't have any doctor, you live a happy life in hospital your whole life. You'll never get out of the place. Because the nurses can't give you a permanent solution. The doctor can. So who's more important? Both are important. So spiritual knowledge is like the doctor. That's going to get you out of this world. But then we also offer other temporary help which helps people here. But have you noticed, generally, who are there more of? Nurses or doctors?
Nurses.
More nurses, generally. Less doctors. What is it, harder to become a doctor or a nurse?
Doctor.
Who gets paid more, a doctor or a nurse?
Doctor.
So doctors are more rare. So spiritual knowledge is like that. It's very rare. So therefore we focus there. Because that's what the world needs.
Thank you so much for that, Maharaj. That sounds good. Maybe I might come back to that later on because I'm still not satisfied. So, but in the meanwhile, okay. You know, for 20 years of your life you spent as a celibate monk. And recently we're all aware that you took the renunciate life. What made you take on that decision? What made you take on that choice? Why did you choose it? What's the difference between the two?
Yeah, so nowadays you can see I walk around with one of these. It's a good weapon. And it's, you know, people tend to pay attention when you hold one of these. What is it exactly? This is the staff of a renunciate. And in the Vedic system, there are two types of monks. One is called a brahmachari, and another one is called a sannyasi. So brahmachari means a student monk, and a sannyasi means a lifelong renunciate. So it's many people will become a student monk for some part of their life, and then as you were, and then at some point in time they will make a transition and then get married and have a very spiritual life through family life, and that's wonderful. And there are some monks who will decide that after their student training that they want to live their entire life as monks. And when they do that, they take a vow known as sannyas, in which they close all the other doors and they say, for the rest of this life, this is what I'll do, and I will not deviate from that. I will remain focused. When you take sannyas, then you hold one of these staffs. In this staff is four bamboo rods. I got them from B&Q. When they're supposed to get them from a sacred forest, but what to do? So it's got four bamboo rods and they're joined by 12 pieces of string. Three of the rods represent the body, mind and words, and the fourth rod, which is slightly shorter, represents the soul. And so all these rods are bound together, and it signifies that the sannyasi, or the lifelong renunciate, tries to dedicate their body, mind, words in the service of God, in the service of others, giving spirituality and trying to raise the consciousness of the world. And so a sannyasi carries this around. not literally everywhere. Someone asked me the other day, do you sleep with that in your bed? Not exactly, but... So it's a vow, and then someone may say, well, what's the need to make that vow? Well, it's a commitment. It's like, what's the need to take a marriage vow? Anyone here took a marriage vow? You people looking very like miserable there. Come on, it's not that bad. Yeah, you took a marriage vow. Why did you take a marriage vow? You could have just been together for your whole life. Why did you take a marriage vow?
It's a system,
okay?
It's a lifelong commitment.
It's a commitment. It's an exhibition of your commitment to that person. It's an exhibition of love. It's a sense that, no, we invest in this relationship. So the sannyas vow is like that. Just that instead of getting married to a person, you get married to a stick. Not just married to a stick, but married to the mission of trying to uplift others. So Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita actually gives a deeper definition of sannyas. And in Sanskrit, what he says, anashrita karma phalam karyam karma karotiya sa sanyasi cha yogi cha nani ragnena cha kriyaha. Who is actually a sannyasi? Is it one who carries a stick? Is it one who dresses like this? Is it one who takes a formal vow of renunciation? Krishna says no. The real sannyasi, the real renunciate, is the one who has given up all selfish desires. When you give up your selfish desire, that is actually the real meaning of sannyas. So actually, sannyas is not just dress, it's not just an external change, but it's actually an internal change of heart. And sometimes someone may be living in a married life, but they may be more of a sannyasi than even a sannyasi, if they live in a very, very selfless way. Does that help?
Yes, Mark, but you're quite young. So don't you find that overwhelming to have taken that sort of stage and phase of your life? Isn't there anything that you regret? Especially what to think of in the future, if you may think that one day, oh, I would like, you know, get married.
41. Or is 41 young? It's young, I guess. Srila Prabhupada, once he was in India and he was giving sannyas to a 26-year-old.
Wow.
And one reporter said, but sannyas is for old people. Sannyas you take in your old age. So Prabhupada said, yes, you're right. But Prabhupada said, what does it mean to be old? So the reporter, he couldn't answer. He was a young person in age. So Prabhupada said, can you guarantee, Prabhupada said, old means close to death. So Prabhupada looked at this young reporter and he said, can you guarantee you will live longer than me? The reporter said, no, I could die tomorrow. So Prabhupada said, therefore, you are old, I am old, he is old, everyone is old. Because life is so unpredictable that we don't know what will happen. Old means close to death. So therefore, Gandhi, he said, if there's something good and you can do it today, why wait till tomorrow? So there's a sense in which when an opportunity comes in spiritual life, there may be some good discrimination in waiting. But there's another side of it where we seize the day and take the opportunity. And is it a risk? Is it a risk? Yes, it's a risk. It's a risk to take sannyas. Is it a risk to not take sannyas?
Yes.
Yeah, it's a risk. Is it a risk to get married?
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Not me. Is it a risk not to get married?
Yeah.
Yes. Everything's a risk. Everything is a risk. Is it a risk to sit on that chair? I'm not preparing you for anything. Yes, everything is a risk. Sometimes we think not doing something is safe and doing something is a risk. That is a complete illusion. Did you know that not doing something is just as risky as doing something?
Mm.
Do you agree with me?
Mm-hmm.
Come and join me. It's risky not to. Everyone has their part.
Especially for some of us, not many of us, we may think that the life of a sannyasi is very easy. Just travel and just preach. But what does it really consist of other than that? Well, how do you usually spend your time?
Is it easy?
No.
I think every life has its difficulties and its perks. Yeah, I was just in the Swiss Alps. That was nice. What's there, sannyas? Okay, let's go to the Alps. It was nice. And yes, it does have a difficulty. Sometimes you're traveling a lot. Sometimes you don't know where will you be day after day. Moving all the time. But there are many nice things. But the ultimate... So you're asking me, what do I do as a sannyasi? Yeah, so as a sannyasi, we try to, as I mentioned, share spiritual knowledge with people by giving lectures, but also by discussing with people one-to-one, spending time with each other, empowering, inspiring each other. We write books. We also manage... So management is also there. What to do? You can't escape. Also doing some management. So we do many different things. Every life will have its difficulties and its perks. So we take the rough with the smooth, and we make the best of the opportunities.
Okay, so now I'm going to ask you questions that has a little bit more to do with the problems of the world. Because
yeah,
we'll
do 5-10 more minutes, yeah. And then we can open it out to everyone.
Yeah. When I came into the Krishna consciousness movement and in the ashram, we were talking a lot about ahimsa. You know how we have our own cows,
non-violence, yeah.
You know, particularly towards the cows. And how, you know, we drink ahimsa milk, we try and stick to that. But nowadays, in some temples, we may see that they're actually buying milk from shops. That means, to some degree, and I actually did come across this, someone said that you're just supporting the cruelty towards animals. How can you actually explain that? How can you sort of balance that? So we're trying to preach a philosophy of don't be cruel to animals, and
especially
cows. Yes. But still, we're buying milk.
Yeah. Thank you for this question. If we look at the world today and the way the cows are treated, then in the factory farming, cows are milked, often in a very cruel way. And then the cruelty on top of that is when the cows stop giving milk, then they slaughter. So then someone may say, how can you support such a thing by drinking milk? How can you support that industry? We should become vegan. So there's a few points to consider here. The first thing is that humans and animals, and humans and especially the cows, have a natural relationship. So when the mother stops giving milk, then the human is continued to be nourished by milk, which is the miracle food, the milk of the cows. Therefore, the cow is considered the mother of humankind. And therefore, it's very natural for humans to drink milk. Not just physically, but Srila Prabhupada explained even on the brain tissue, the milk is nourishing so you can spiritually advance as well. So milk is a very, very important part of our diet. But now the question is, when that milk is produced in that way, is it still a good thing to have? There are different opinions on this even in the Hare Krishna movement. Many of our devotees refuse to drink milk from the supermarkets. They will not drink milk. Some devotees say they will only have ahimsa milk. You understand? Ahimsa milk. That means there are certain farms which have been created across the country where cows are taken care of properly. They're milked in a very kind way, in a loving way. And then when they stop giving milk, they continue to be cared for till the natural end of their life comes. So like this, we have some ahimsa farms and we want to expand more. So some devotees will only take ahimsa milk. So the first thing is that different devotees do approach this in different ways. But now your question is, why in our temples do we still have milk? Because there are two things to consider here. The first thing is that milk is still an important part of our diet for spiritual reasons. And not everyone will have access to ahimsa milk. So we still take that milk because of its benefit in terms of our ongoing nourishment and spiritual development. However, at the same time, we are making an active contribution and effort to create a different alternative. Therefore, what many devotees do, when they buy a pint of milk from the supermarket, they say, for every pint of milk that I buy, I'm going to set aside, say, 20 pence that goes towards cow protection and creating ahimsa farms. And if everyone did that and said, for every milk, because some cruelty has gone into this, I should make a solution. And they set aside something for every pint of milk. If everyone did that, we could have a central fund which would then create many farms, which would then create a positive alternative. So as devotees in the Hare Krishna movement, we're not just looking at how to abstain ourselves from it, but we're ultimately looking at how to make a positive alternative. So yes, but you're right, even many devotees will avoid milk. That's a personal choice. We also know that when a cow gives milk and is offered to Krishna, then that milk, which is then offered to Krishna, gives the cow great spiritual benefit as well. So even in all of that cruelty, the cow will still get benefit. But we should not use these arguments to divest ourselves of the responsibility to make a positive alternative. And we're trying to do that.
Thank you so much. One last question, and perhaps maybe then we can open up for everyone else. So this may be also a very controversial one. And then it's all credit to you. So in Shastra we see that it's a very sort of male dominative, acharyas, and Srila Prabhupada says very intense things sometimes about women. It kind of almost seems like he sets a certain rules for women and another rules for men. And, for someone that may come into the Krishna consciousness movement, it may almost seem like, we have a very negative perspective of women in general. So, again, how do we sort of clear that sort of doubt in people's mind?
Yeah. The first thing is that when we look at our lineage of teachers, then we find amongst the generations that some of the most exalted personalities within our lineages were ladies. For example, even here today, we have the teachings of Queen Kunti, which we read. We have Janava Mata, who was the wife of Nityananda Prabhu, who was considered the leader of the Vaishnavas of her time. We find even in Srila Prabhupada's time that Srila Prabhupada gave ladies very high responsibilities. He sat while they lectured in front of him and they became teachers of Krishna consciousness. And so when we look at the position of ladies within our Vedic culture, we have to see all the different angles. Of course, India had its culture in which there were certain gender roles. And sometimes what has been done over the centuries is that those traditional gender roles have been taken and then they've been exploited and misinterpreted and misapplied. One thing we have to realize is that there is a difference between men and ladies. When we talk about gender equality, we should not try to reduce gender equality to gender sameness. Sometimes the way in which they try to create equality in the world today is by trying to make everything artificially the same. But that's not an intelligent way of doing it. Men and women are different. Men and women have different strengths and different weaknesses. And therefore we have to look at the physical frame which we've been given and then find the best way in which we can empower each other to then use that body in the service of God to ultimately reach perfection. So basically what we're saying is that Srila Prabhupada gave opportunities, the highest opportunities to ladies. Just like here, we are worshipping on the altar. And in traditional Vedic culture, Indian culture, ladies would not be on the altar. But Srila Prabhupada gave that opportunity, recognizing that our times are different and opportunities should be there. So we're a living tradition and we're moving and we're evolving. And in this way, Srila Prabhupada's movement is about empowering and giving everyone the full opportunity to utilize their talents and abilities. Those are some thoughts.
Thank you very much. So maybe anyone may have a question from the audience?
Hare Krishna. So I was wondering the why of all of the philosophical traditions of the world you landed on Krishna consciousness and why you've dedicated your life to that, and also if you could share a little bit about why you believe it to be true. I feel everyone could benefit from hearing that.
Okay, thank you. Very nice question. You believe that every religion in the world, if practiced with sincerity, can lead you closer to God. Srila Prabhupada, when he went around the world, he met Christians and he said, just be a better Christian. He met Muslims and told them, be a better Muslim. Whatever religious tradition we find ourselves in, if we practice it to a higher level of purity and sincerity, it will lead to a deeper connection with God. So in that sense, we see that there is a unity between all the religions in the world in their diversity. However, we do also see that there is an evolution amongst these religions. They all can give you spiritual benefit, but they all have different levels of detail in their revelation of the ultimate absolute truth. I could have a pocket dictionary here, and I could have a complete full Cambridge dictionary here. And they're both right. However, they have a different level of detail. So when I studied all the different religions, and I did undertake a study of different religions, when I came to the Vedic tradition, the Bhagavad Gita, the Srimad Bhagavatam, then I saw a level of detail, a level of insight, a level of intimacy of relationship with God that, to be honest, you never find anywhere else. In our literatures, it doesn't just tell you God is great. It tells you what God looks like, what He does every single day, what His relationships with His devotees are, what He eats, and how to actually interact with Him in a very real way. And so that leads on to your second question, which is why did I then take up Krishna consciousness? Because not only was it philosophically the most advanced theology I had encountered, but simultaneously, it was a theology in which I felt, here I can experience God. Here I can connect with God and feel and perceive the direct presence of God in my life. And that was exciting. So Krishna consciousness is not just a religion which is meant to make you believe in God. That's just the beginning. This path of Krishna consciousness is meant to empower you to perceive the presence of God at every step. And that's the great offer of Krishna consciousness. Srila Prabhupada never presented it as a religion, he presented it as a spiritual science. And therefore, there will be a direct observation of everything that you're reading in the books. I hope that helps.
Thank you.
Yes.
Hare Krishna Prabhu. Thanks for a wonderful class, question and answer. My question is, I saw your book, the name is Gita 3. So why is it only 3? Why not 2 or why 4? It's a serious question. Why is it only 3?
Yeah, so it could be 4 or 5, but this is Gita 3 because what we do in this book is we go through the 18 chapters of the Gita 3 times. Maybe in the future I'll write a book and go through it 5 times, and then we call it Gita 5. But because in this book, what we do, we go through the 18 chapters of the Gita 3 times. When I go through the first time, the 18 chapters, I try to share with you how every chapter of the Gita teaches you to think differently to how you've been taught growing up. In the second time I go through the 18 chapters of the Gita, I try to share with you how in every chapter of the Gita, Krishna teaches you how to do amazing things. He teaches you how to be determined, how to find love, how to have the best relationships, how to free yourself from stress. So that's the second part. And in the third time, when I go through the 18 chapters of the Gita, I try to show you how in every chapter of the Gita, Krishna removes every conceivable excuse you could come up with as to why you can't practice spiritual life. Someone may say, I can't do it because I don't have time. Krishna removes that. Someone may say, I can't do it because I'm not intelligent enough. Krishna removes that. Someone may say, I can't do it because I want to do something practical to help the world. Krishna removes that. He removes every excuse you can come up with. And so, this section has, this book has 3 sections. And therefore, it's Gita 3.
Thank you.
Thanks. Thank you. I didn't plant that question so I could promote it. But thank you for letting me do that.
Thank you so much, Dhanabhu Pranam. It's good to see you again after Shankarsan Sanctuary in London.
Yes, you were there, presence there.
Yes, I remember seeing you there. My question is basically, I've got friends that are in the restaurant trade and they deal with meat, but deep down they really want to be spiritual. But obviously, working that trade is very hard to get out of that trade and practice the spirituality. And sometimes they feel demoralized, but deep down they've got intention to actually really go forward.
Yes.
What advice would you give them?
Yeah, you know, like we come to Krishna consciousness once our life is already set up in a certain way. And then you realize, oh my God, this is not compatible. Have you ever been driving on a motorway and then you get so distracted that you miss your exit? Isn't that annoying? And then it's like, oh no, I just missed the exit.
It normally happens.
Yeah, it normally happens, right? And then all you want to do in that moment is just like turn around. But that would not be very good for your health. It's very dangerous. You can't do that. So then when you miss the exit on the motorway, what do you have to do? You just have to wait. And you have to say, okay, I've got to drive. And all the time you're driving, you're thinking, but I'm going away from where I'm meant to be going. Well, what to do? You have to drive. Then you get to the next exit. Then you slow down. Then you come off. Then you go on the roundabout. You come back. You get back onto the motorway. Then you start driving back. And then you take the exit again. Because you can't just turn your car in one moment like that. Mm. Life is like that. We came to Krishna consciousness and it's like, oh my God, I missed the exit. And now you got all these things in your life, bad job, this, that. How can you just stop working? You need to pay your bills. So what we need to do is be patient and realize that step by step, I have to make my life Krishna conscious. If someone is a butcher, that's not very good for Krishna consciousness, but they may have a very good desire. So what they need to do eventually is start going into the newspaper and looking at some other vacancies or other jobs. And gradually try to move yourself out of that. In the time when you're taking to move yourself out of that situation, Krishna is kind. Krishna understands that you can't do it immediately. So He will not hold it against you. But as long as you're making the endeavor to then go towards a life where you're not involved in such things. So nowadays there are so many jobs. Nowadays there are so many ways to survive. So gradually, if we're caught in something like that, we have to make a step-by-step plan to try to come out of that. Is that fair?
Thank you so much for that.
But it's a step-by-step. It's not that tomorrow. A step-by-step, because you see, in meat eating, multiple parties get the reaction. The person who kills the animal, the person who transports the animal, the person who sells the animal, the person who's working in that environment, the person who buys the thing, the person who eats it, all are involved in the karmic chain. So we look at our life and we think, you know what, I already got a heavy load of karma on my back. I don't know if I want to add to it more unnecessarily. So you have to just be careful a little bit. Like, try to live a karma-free life. Yeah. Yes. Just tell me, Prabhu, when we need to stop.
Oh, please, carry on.
Hare Krishna Maharaj.
Thank you, Krishna.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Thank you, Prabhu Maharaj. My question is, I'm going to be very open and reflective here. We mentioned upstairs that once someone told Prabhupada, I want to go to a nightclub and preach. I work in the corporate world, and often, initially I had a bit of guilt around this, and then I found myself going to bars, I don't drink, but striking spiritual conversations there. And I realized a lot of times the people who are seeking Krishna consciousness without knowing are the ones that are actually at the bars. There's something that they're seeking, or maybe overcompensating it with alcohol. But the more I went, and the more I spoke with people, part of me, I guess this is part of my false ego, started saying, they're in Maya. And then I have to remind myself, hey, Krishna has a plan for everybody. I need to be patient. I need to understand where they're coming from. What do you think we can do as devotees to understand where the other person's coming from? In a way, I'd say I'm lucky because I used to drink, I used to eat meat. So sometimes when they strike certain conversations, I know why they're saying what they're saying.
You can relate.
I can relate very well. But now, that was years ago, 3 years ago, 4 years ago. And now I'm like, they're in Maya. So am I. How can I, one, remind myself that, be patient, try and understand what this person's need is, as you mentioned earlier upstairs. And secondly, I'm still new to the movement, but how can I develop myself, how can I raise my own consciousness in a way to firstly understand the need, but also address and answer what they might be like. Thank you.
Yes, very reflective question. Yes, people are everywhere. We can't stereotype. Maybe we should be over there in that park. I have a program there. Probably a few people questioning there. You see, one who really wants to share Krishna consciousness has to be completely non-judgmental. If you treat someone as they are, they will remain as they are. But if you treat them as they can and should be, they'll become what they can and should be. Devotee is always encouraging, inspiring, empowering. Srila Prabhupada had grown up in impeccable Vedic culture, and then he just came down to the Skid Row in New York, and he was just living with people who were on LSD, people who were into free love, and people who were just doing every nefarious activity under the sun, and Prabhupada just lived with them so naturally. There was no sense of holier than thou, just so kind. One of Srila Prabhupada's disciples, he went to jail, so he called Prabhupada. And he said, "Prabhupada, I've been really stupid." Prabhupada said, "Don't worry, we're all stupid." He said, no, Srila Prabhupada, I'm in jail." Prabhupada said, "Don't worry, Krishna was born in jail." Then he said, so Prabhupada said, "What was the crime?" He said, "Prabhupada, I was dealing drugs." Prabhupada said, "Don't worry, I was also dealing drugs." Because Prabhupada was a pharmacist. He said, "Don't worry, I was also dealing, a bit different drugs." So Prabhupada was so kind. He was so encouraging. He was so non-judgmental. He never saw all of the conditionings, all the limitations, all the anarthas, but he saw a spark of sincerity. And what did Prabhupada do? He fanned the spark. He fanned the spark. So, as ones who are trying to go in the world and help others, we have to try to see where there is potential, where there is good, where there's an entrance point. And then use that to try and resolve all the other negativity that is there, all the bad things. So, yes, we should not judge anyone. We were also, they say, every saint had a past, and every sinner has a future. I saw that behind, in front of the church once. Every saint has a past, and every sinner has a future. Be kind. You're already doing that. And yeah, do it at the bars. Maybe you'll find a few people. That would be nice.
It's possible.
We need everyone, everywhere. Yeah. Devotees used to do Gauranga, isn't it? They used to do the Gauranga stickers. Used to go everywhere. Clubs, pubs, bridges. On all the bridges, I see Gauranga. So they stopped one person once on the street. They gave him a book and he said, "Before you go, can you say Gauranga?" He said, "Gauranga? Yeah, Gauranga. I know Gauranga." He said, "You know Gauranga?" He goes, "Yeah, I know Gauranga. That's the company that makes all the motorway bridges." Gauranga does build a bridge. He builds a bridge, isn't it, to the spiritual world. So he's very kind. So yeah, the devotees will go here, there, and anywhere. Prabhupada just was willing to go anywhere. Lower East Side, New York, 1965. That was not a good place to go. If you think Moss Side is bad. Rather when that was the height of compassion. Allen Ginsberg, you know Allen Ginsberg? He's the beat poet. He's quite eccentric. But he loved Prabhupada. And he said it was the height of compassion that the Swami, all of the Swamis at that time, they were going to uptown New York. And they were going for the high class audience, the yogis, the, you know. But Prabhupada said no. He was in uptown New York, but he said, "No, I'm going to go down to the depths of the Lower East Side." So once Brahmananda Prabhu, he was in Vrindavan. You know Brahmananda Prabhu? He was Prabhupada's early disciple. He was talking about Prabhupada with such love, and then one devotee put his hand up and he said, "The way you talk about Prabhupada, it seems as though for you, Prabhupada is God." Ramananda, he said, no, Prabhupada is not God. He said, nowadays, I think Prabhupada is greater than God. Because Prabhupada came down to the Lower East Side to save me. And then he just began crying. Krishna came, but Krishna didn't come to the Lower East Side. Prabhupada came and carried Krishna to the Lower East Side. That's so kind. So it must be kind. Thank you so much. I see many hands, so I don't know where to go. There's one here, and then Alice is there.
Alice,
here.
You can take a question from there.
Alice.
Hare Krishna. Sannyasi means renunciation from the world as well as from the relationships. So my question to you is that, is the sannyasi still a son to his parents? Does he still have son's duty towards his parents? And if no, then how fair is it towards the parents, and in cases when he's the only son? And if yes, then how would that sannyasi be able to be in that mode of renunciation? Because no matter the parents are, more senior to him, but they might not be in the same state as that person, and they might bring him or drag him towards their materialistic problems. So just wanted to ask that.
Yes, thank you for asking. Yes, this is a very important point. When one takes sannyas, then they live away from home. He said that the sannyasi gives up the world of family life in order to embrace the whole world as his family. But where does that leave your mother and father? Your mother and father who did so much for you, who sacrificed, who cared for you. Of course, when you take sannyas, it's not that you can't meet your mother or father again. Of course, there are some orders like that. In ISKCON, it's not that we can't meet our mother or father. So, I saw my mom a few weeks ago, and I see my mother regularly. Although I don't live at home, I don't stay there overnight, because I have a certain path I'm following. Now, when one takes sannyas, then what they do is they make sure that there's enough provisions in place so that their parents will be taken care of. And that is for each sannyasi to make all of those arrangements before they take that step. So it's not that, it's not cold, it's not ungrateful, it's not neglectful that we just walk away and we just leave them hanging. No, we will make an arrangement so that they will be cared for. However, what the sannyasi or the renunciate does is that they're actually giving back to their parents in the greatest way. Because what is the real duty of a son or a daughter? Is to take care on a physical level, is to take care on an emotional level, but the real duty of a son or daughter is actually to help their parents spiritually as well. And whatever bhakti you do, whatever devotion you do, that will be for the benefit of your parents also. Isn't it? It's said that just by the devotion of Prahlad, how many generations of his family were liberated just by his devotion? So, when I left home and left my parents, it was difficult, naturally, and it was emotional for them. They want to see you. Mother wants to see you married. Full stop. One time my mom, she just looked at me. She said it with such sincerity. She's so frustrated, but it was very sweet. She just looked at me and she said, "Can't you just be normal?" And I thought, "Mom, it's gone too far, I've lost it, I can't do it now." So yeah, naturally, motherly affection is there. Prabhupada said, the purest type of love in this world is the love between a mother and a child. I thought about that one time, that in my life, every single relationship changed. With my father, it changed. With my guru, it changed. With even devotees, it changed. But the only one relationship in my life which has never changed to this day is my relationship with
Krishna.
Even with Krishna, it changes. When I go home now to see my mom, the first thing she asks me, where is your laundry? If I don't go home without something for her to wash, I won't hear the end of it. So sometimes I take clean clothes just for her to wash, because she wants to wash something. That's the service spirit of a mother. So, yes, anyway, in answer to your question, yes, we can still see our parents. Number two, we make provisions so that they will be cared for. And number three, we realize that actually what we're doing is the greatest service to them. Because hopefully, if we do anything useful in our life, which hopefully I've got some more years to try and do something useful, if I do something useful by Krishna's grace, then the benefit will go to her. But still, having said all of that, still for a mother to hear what another mother has to go through like that, it will be tough. Even Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's mother, even the Supreme Lord's mother, when he took sannyas, she was crying and crying and crying and crying. Once we met a sannyasi in Venezuela. He was a sannyasi and he had 22 siblings, 22 brothers and sisters. So he was the 23rd and he took sannyas. And he said, you know what? When I took sannyas, my mother cried and cried and cried. Meaning like, got 22 other brothers and sisters. I mean, one becomes a sannyasi. Hare Krishna. That's good. She said, even then my mother cried and it's a bond, isn't it? So it's there. She's okay. She's happy. I think she's happy. If she's watching online. Hare Krishna. Yes. We are going on a long time. I mean, I'm okay, but I'm just like, everyone's here. I don't want to unsettle. It's kind of hot.
Yeah, it's fine.
Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
The question I want to ask is about physical material desires and wants. I'm really new to the movement, so excuse me if I'm ignorant to anything. But this is just my understanding at the moment, so with physical wants and desires, like, it was trying to understand for myself, really, kind of what is kind of the best way to go about it. So, like, I was thinking in absolutes, meaning that, oh, I'm not allowed to have any physical, material wants or desires. I'm not allowed. He's kind of shunned upon. That's just how I viewed it, as I read through some of the texts. So I guess I just appreciate like your viewpoint on that. The viewpoint that I've now come to myself, like from my own kind of questioning, was it's okay to have those wants and desires, but you don't become attached to the wants and desires themselves. But I just appreciate your thoughts on that.
Yeah, we have desires in this world. It's not that, for example, here we talk about sannyas and then walking away from a relationship in that way, like with a member of the opposite gender. But for many people, that's a desire. And that's a very valid desire. Mm. So we just have to then fulfill that desire in such a way that two people then come together and they honor and respect and serve and inspire each other so that they both rise higher to Krishna. Mm. Then you can fulfill that desire in such a way that it contributes to your spirituality. Mm. Some people have a desire to have a career. Some people are career people. For me, it's like I graduated from university. The only job I ever had in my life was I was a baggage handler at Heathrow. Because I needed to get, after I graduated, I needed to get enough money to go to India. So I became a baggage handler at Heathrow. You know those people who wreck your luggage? I didn't do that, but some people do. In 2 months at Heathrow Airport, working as a baggage handler, I read the whole Chaitanya Charitamrita on the job. It was the best job. An 8-hour shift, you just do 3 planes, takes about 3 hours. 5 hours, you can just sit and read. I was sitting by the runway, Terminal 2 runway, you know those buggies? I was sitting in a run on the side of a runway in a buggy, reading Chaitanya Charitamrita. It was a good life. I read more in those 2 months than I read in my life.
Amazing.
Anyway, so you learn to use your desires. Some people are career people. So then be the best. Do good in your career. And then when you rise to the heights of your career success, use that influence to spread spirituality in the world. George Harrison was an incredible musician. So when he wanted to join the movement, and what did Prabhupada tell him? Don't. Prabhupada said, you don't need to be initiated by me, you're already Hari's son. Hari means Krishna, God. You're already the son of God. You just make music and introduce people to Krishna through music. So then that's what he did. I really want to see you. I really want to see you. But it came so long. These songs, how many people got connected? So yeah, use your desires. Redirect them in such a way that they will bring great opportunities to advance yourself spiritually. You're talented. Krishna's given you so many abilities. Use it. Taji in front of you is a musician. So then he makes music for Krishna. Maybe one day you can ask him to perform.